Though it was true, Anna had rid herself of opium's dragon. She had cured herself when he had tried for over a decade to do the same, remaining always that shapeless creature's slave. Anna made a little snatching motion with her hand, as though wishing to steady herself upon the frame of the door. In a whisper she said,
"But you can't come in. You can't come in, Arsuk."
Arsuk waited a moment before he made his bow, for he trusted his own first impressions, and he wished to make this impression last. She was much thinner than he remembered. He could see the bones of her wrist quite plainly, and her cheeks were sunken in.
"Good afternoon," he said.
"What do you want?" Anna whispered.
"Yes, good afternoon. You know I'm not taking opium anymore. Did you know that?"
He peered at her.
3 weeks," she added, as if to persuade him. "I haven't had a pipe in 3 weeks."
"How?"
said Arsuk. She shook her head.
"You have to understand it. I'm not the same as I was."
"Why you come no more to Canieri?"
Arsuk said. He did not know how to say that he missed her, that each afternoon before her arrival he used to arrange the cushions on the daybed just so, and tidy his belongings, and make sure his clothes were neat and his pigtail tied, that, as he watched her sleep, he had often been near choked with joy, that he had sometimes reached out his hand and let it hover within an inch of her breast, as though he could feel the softness of her skin in that smoky space between his flesh and hers, that sometimes after she took her pipe, he would wait some time before taking his own, so that he could watch her and fix her image in his mind to remember.
"I can't come to see you any more," Anna said. "You mustn't be here. I can't come."
Arsuk studied her sadly.
"No more smoke?"
"No more," Anna said. "No more smoke, and no more Canieri."
"Why?"
"I can't explain it, not here. I've stopped, Arsuk. I've stopped it altogether."
"No more money?"
said Arsuk, trying to understand. He knew that Anna had laboured under an enormous debt. She owed a great deal of money to Dick Mannering, and the debt mounted every day. Perhaps she could no longer afford the drug. Or perhaps she could no longer afford the time to make the journey to take it.
"It's not money,"
Anna said. Just then a female voice called out Anna's name from deep in the well of the house, and asked, in a tone of impatient condescension, to know the name and business of the caller at the door. Anna turned her chin to the side, but did not move her eyes from Arsuk's face.
"It's just a chink I used to know," she called. "It's nothing." "Well, what does he want?"
"Nothing,"
Anna called again.
"He's only trying to sell me something."
There was a silence.
"I bring to you here,"
said Arsuk. He cupped his hands together and proffered them to her, indicating that he was willing to deliver the resin himself.
"No,"
Anna whispered.
"No, you can't do that. It's no use. The thing is, I can't feel it anymore."
Arsuk did not understand this.
"Last piece," he said,
meaning the ounce he had gifted her on the afternoon of her near death.
"Last piece. Unlucky?"
"No,"
Anna began. But before she could speak further, there were quick steps in the passage, and in the next moment a second woman had appeared at Anna's side.
"Good afternoon," she said. "What is it that you are selling?
That will do, Anna." And at once Anna melted back from the doorway. Arsuk had also taken a step backwards, but in shock rather than submission, for this was the first he had seen of Lydia Greenway in nearly 13 years. The last time that he had laid eyes upon her was when? At the Sydney courthouse. She in the gallery, he in the dock. She, red-faced, fanning herself with an embroidered sandalwood fan, the scent of which had floated down to reach him, recalling, in a rush of emotion, his family's warehouse on the Guangzhou waterfront, and the sandalwood boxes in which the merchants packed their bolts of silk before the wars. She'd been wearing a gown of pale green, this he remembered well, and a bonnet covered in lace. She had kept her face perfectly grave throughout the trial. Her testimony, when she gave it, had been short and to the point. Ah Suk had not understood a word of it, save for when she pointed directly at him, evidently to identify him to the court. When Ah Suk was acquitted of the murder, she had betrayed no emotion of any kind. She had only risen, mutely, and left the courtroom without a backward glance. Over 12 years had passed since that day. Over 12 years, and yet here she was, monstrously present, monstrously unchanged. Her copper hair was as bright as ever. Her skin was fresh and hardly lined. She was as plump and buxom as Anna was gaunt. In the next moment, her features also slackened, which was unusual, for Lydia's expressions were typically very artfully manicured, and she did not like to show surprise, and her eyes became wide.
"I know this man," she said in a tone of astonishment. She brought her hand up to her throat. "I know him."
Anna looked from Ah Suk to Mrs. Wells and then back again.
"How?" she said. "Not from Canieri."
Ah Suk had acquired a film of perspiration on his upper lip. He said nothing, however, and merely bowed. Perhaps they would think that he could not understand them. He turned back to Anna, feeling that if he kept eye contact with Lydia Greenway for even a moment longer, she would recall where they had met before. He could still feel her in the periphery of his eye, watching him. Anna was frowning too.
"Perhaps you're thinking of a different man," she said to Mrs. Wells. "It's often hard to tell Chinamen apart." "Yes, perhaps," said Mrs. Wells, but she was still staring at Ah Suk.
Whether she had placed him already or not, he could not tell. He cast about for something to say to Anna, but his mind was blank.
"What do you want, Ah Suk?" said Anna.
She did not speak unkindly, but with longing. There was a pleading, almost fearful look in her eye.
"What did you call him?"
said the older woman, quickly.
"Ah Suk," Anna said. "Mr. Suk, I suppose. He's the dealer at Canieri."
"Ah!"
Her gaze sharpened immediately.
"Opium!"
So she had placed him. She had remembered who he was. At once, Ah Suk changed his tack. He turned to Anna and announced,
"I buy you, top price."
The widow laughed.
"Oh,"
Anna said. She had flushed very red.
"No, you can't do that. I suppose nobody told you. I'm done with whoring now. I'm not a whore any longer. No selling. Not for sale."
"What you now?" said Ah Suk.
"Miss Wetherill is my assistant," said Mrs. Wells.
But Ah Suk did not know the word.
"She lives here now." "I live here now," Anna echoed. "I don't take opium any more. Do you understand? No more smoke. I've given it up."
Ah Suk was bewildered.
"Well, goodbye," Anna said. "Thank you for calling."
Suddenly, Mrs. Wells' wrist shot out. She grabbed Ah Suk's forearm in her milky hand and squeezed it tight.
"You must come to the seance this evening," she said. "He doesn't have a ticket," Anna said. "An oriental presence," said Mrs. Wells, ignoring her. "It will be just the thing. What did you call him again?"
"Ah Suk," said Anna.
"Oh, yes," said Mrs. Wells. "Just think of it. An oriental presence at this evening's seance." "Is a seance an oriental practice?"
Anna said doubtfully. Ah Suk did not know the word, but he knew oriental, and guessed that he was the subject of their discussion, and the cause, presumably, of Lydia's sudden look of greed. It was astonishing to him that she could have changed so little over the course of a decade, when Anna, over the course of a month, had altered so very much. Looking down at her hand, wrapped tight around his forearm, he was surprised to see a band of gold upon her finger.
"Mrs. Carver," he said, and pointed to the ring.
The woman smiled more broadly this time.
"I fancy he has a touch of the prophet in him," she said to Anna. "How is that for a notion?" "What do you mean, Mrs. Carver?"
Anna said to Ah Suk. She was frowning.
"Wife of Carver,"
said Ah Suk unhelpfully.
"He thinks you're Carver's wife," said Anna.
"He's only guessing," said Mrs. Wells.
To our sook, she said, "Not Mrs. Carver. My husband is dead. I'm a widow now."
"Not Mrs. Carver?"
"Mrs. Wells."
Our sook's eyes widened.
"Mrs. Wells," he repeated.
"It is very well his English is so limited," the widow said to Anna, conversationally. "That way he will not get distracted. His composure will not falter. Oh, isn't he handsome? He will do us very well, I think."
"He knows Carver," Anna said.
"I'm sure he does," said Mrs. Wells, with a breezy tone. "Captain Carver has a great many Oriental connections. I expect they've done business with each other here in Hokitika. Come into the parlour, Ah, sook."
She gripped his arm tighter.
"Come along, just for a moment. Don't be a baby. I'm not going to hurt you. Come inside."
"Francis Carver, in Guangdong?" said Ah, sook.
"Or in Canton, yes, it's very likely," said Mrs. Wells, mistaking Ah, sook's question for a statement. "Captain Carver was based in Canton. He was based there for many years. Come along into the parlour."
She shepherded Ah, sook into the parlour, pointing to the far corner of the room.
"You will sit upon a cushion there," she said. "You will observe the faces around you and contribute a cool air of judgment to our mystical seance. We shall call you the Eastern Oracle, or the Living Statue of the Orient, or the Dynastic Spirit, or some such thing. Which do you prefer, Anna? The statue or the oracle?"
Anna did not have a preference. It was clear to her that Lydia Wells and Ah, sook recognized each other, and that their shared history had something to do with Francis Carver, and that the widow did not wish to speak of it aloud. She knew better than to press the point, however, and asked,
"What will be his purpose?" "Merely to observe us." "Yes, but to what end?"
The widow waved her hand.
"Didn't you see the spectacle at the Prince of Wales? Nothing sells tickets like an Oriental touch." "He's not unknown in Hokitika, you know," Anna said. "He'll be recognized."
"As will you,"
Mrs. Wells pointed out.
"That won't matter a jot." "I don't know," said Anna. "I'm not sure."
"Anna Wetherill," said Mrs. Wells, with pretended annoyance.
"Do you remember last Thursday, when I proposed hanging the sketch of the Bagatto at the top of the stairs, and you protested, claiming that the print would be shadowed by the attic landing, and then I hung it anyway, and the light was quite as perfect as I promised it would be?"
"Yes," Anna said.
"Well, there," said Mrs. Wells, and laughed.
Ah, sook had not understood a word of this. He turned to Anna and frowned very slightly, to show her that she needed to explain.
"A seance,"
Anna said uselessly. Ah, sook shook his head. He did not know the word.
"Let's try it," said Mrs. Wells. "Come, come to the corner. Anna, get the man a cushion to sit upon. Or would a stool be more ascetic? No, a cushion. Then he can fold his legs as the Eastern men do. Yes, come here, further, further. There."
She pushed Ah, sook down upon the cushion and took several quick steps backwards to appraise him from the other side of the room. She nodded with delight.
"Yes," she said. "Do you see, Anna? Do you not think it fine? How solemn he is. I wonder if we might ask him to smoke a pipe of some kind, for the curling smoke around his head would be rather nice indeed. But smoke indoors makes me ill." "He's not yet given his consent," Anna observed.
Mrs. Wells looked faintly irritated. She did not protest this observation, however, but advanced upon Ah, sook, smiled, and peered down at him, her hands on her hips.
"Do you know Emery Staines?" she said, enunciating clearly. "Emery Staines, do you know him?"
Ah, sook nodded. He knew Emery Staines.
"Well," the woman said, "we are going to bring him here tonight and speak with him. Emery Staines, here."
She pointed at the floorboards with a lemon-scented hand. A ray of understanding passed over Ah, sook's face.
"Excellent,"
The prospector must have been found at last, and found alive. This was good news.
Very good, he said.
Tonight, said Mrs. Wells, here at the Wayfarer's Fortune, in this room.
The party will begin at 7, the seance at 10.
Tonight,
said our Sook, staring at her.
Precisely. You will be here. You will come. You will sit as you are sitting now, yes? Oh, Anna, does he understand? I can hardly tell. His face is such a perfect statue. You see what gave me the idea? The living statue.
Slowly, Anna explained to our Sook that Lydia was requesting his presence that evening at a meeting with Emery Staines. She used the word seance several times. Our Sook, who had no reason to have ever learnt that word, deduced by context that it was a gathering or meeting of some scripted kind which Emery Staines had been invited to attend. He nodded to show that he understood. Anna then explained that our Sook was invited to return that evening and take his place upon the cushion in the corner, exactly as he was sitting now. Other men had also been invited. They would sit in a circle, and Emery Staines would stand in the centre of the room.
"Does he understand it?" said Mrs. Wells. "Does he understand?"
"Yes," said our Sook, and then to show her, "our seance with Emery Staines tonight."
"Excellent,"
said Mrs. Wells, smiling down at him in the same way that one might smile at a precocious child after the recitation of a sonnet, which is to say, with an admiration that was a little distrustful and somewhat contrived.
"A whore in mourning and an Eastern mystic," she went on. "It is quite perfect. I am chilled simply thinking of it. Of course, a seance is not an Oriental tradition,"
in response to Anna's earlier question.
"But have I not said every day this fortnight that in this business the ambiance is half the battle? Our Sook will do us very well."
Anna looked away and said, lightly, "Of course, he must be recompensed." The widow turned upon Anna with a very chilly look, but Anna was not looking at her and could not receive it. In the next moment, her expression cleared again. Carelessly, she said,
"Of course, but you ought to ask him how much he thinks he deserves for such easy work. Ask him, Anna, seeing as you are his special friend."
Anna did so, explaining to our Sook that the widow was willing to pay him a fee for his contribution to the seance that evening. Our Sook, who had not yet understood that Emery Staines was going to be present in spirit only, thought this a wonderful proposition. He was rightly very suspicious of the offer, and made his suspicion known. A rather absurd negotiation followed, and at length our Sook agreed, more for her sake than for his own, to receive a fee of 1 shilling. Our Sook was no fool. He knew very well that he had not really comprehended what was to happen that evening. It was very strange to him that Anna had placed such a high emphasis upon the fact that Emery Staines would stand in the very centre of the room with all the others ranged around him, and it was even stranger still that the widow was willing to pay him a wage for doing nothing at all. He concluded that he was to play a part in a scripted drama of some kind, in which guess, of course, he hit very close upon the mark, and reasoned that whatever humiliation he might suffer as a consequence, it was surely worth it to get a chance to speak to Mr. Staines. He accepted the widow's invitation and her promise of payment in the certainty that his uncertainties would resolve themselves in time. With this, their negotiations were concluded. Our Sook looked at Anna. They held one another's gaze a moment, Our Sook steadily, and Anna, it seemed, with a cool detachment that the hatter did not recognize at all. But was that even detachment? Or was he simply unused to the clarity of her expression, now that her features were not overlaid by opium's thick veil? She was so changed. If he had not known her better, he might have almost called her expression haughty, as though she fancied herself a cut above Chinese society now that she was no longer a whore. Our Sook decided to take her cool expression as a cue to leave, and rose from his cushion. He had calculated that he had time enough to walk to Canyere and back again before the sun went down, and he wished to inform his compatriot Kui Long that Emery Staines would be present that very evening at the Wayfarer's Fortune on Revel Street. He knew that Arqui had long desired an audience with Staines, wishing to interrogate the young prospector upon the matter of the Aurora gold. He would be very pleased to discover that Staines was alive. Arsuk bowed to the widow, and then to Anna. Anna returned his bow with a shallow curtsy, the kind that bespoke neither longing nor regret, and then turned away at once to straighten the lace on the arm of the sofa.
"You'll be back tonight for the séance, tonight," said Lydia Wells. "Say 6 o'clock."
6 o'clock,
Arsuk echoed, and pointed at the cushion he had just vacated to show that he understood. He glanced one last time at Anna, and then Lydia Wells gripped his arm and ushered him into the foyer. She reached around him and opened the door, flooding the space with the sudden light of the day.
"Goodbye,"
said Arsuk, and stepped over the lintel. But the widow did not close the door behind him, as he had expected. Instead, she reached for her shawl, wrapped it around her shoulders, and followed Arsuk out onto the veranda. To Anna, she said,
"I'm going out for a spell. I'll be back in an hour or so."
Anna, from the parlour, looked up in astonishment. Then her expression closed. She nodded woodenly, crossed the parlour, and came to the door to latch it in Mrs. Wells' wake.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Wells," she said, her hand on the frame. "Good afternoon, Arsuk."
They descended the steps to the street, where they parted ways, Arsuk to the south towards the river, and Lydia Wells to the north. After several steps, Mrs. Wells cast a look over her shoulder, as if to appraise the building from the street, and Anna hurriedly moved to close the door. She kept her hand upon the knob, however, and did not turn it. After a moment, she opened it again, very quietly and carefully, and put her eye to the crack. Lydia was walking swiftly now. She had not turned, as Anna had expected she might, to pursue Arsuk and demand a private audience with him. Anna pulled the door open a little wider. Would she double back? Surely that was why she had left so abruptly, to talk in private with the man she so very plainly recognized. But presently, Arsuk rounded the corner on Gibson Quay and disappeared, and Lydia Wells, at almost the same moment, stepped over the ditch at the side of the road and mounted the steps of, Anna squinted, which establishment? A two-storied building beside Tigreen's Hardware and Supply. One of the saloons, perhaps. Evidently there was someone on the porch, for Lydia Wells lingered for a moment, exchanging words, before she opened the door of the establishment and disappeared inside. And as the door swung to, Anna caught a flash of pale blue paint and recognized the building. So Lydia Wells had gone to pay a social call. But upon whom? Anna shook her head in wonderment. Well, she thought, whoever it was, he was not a common digger by any measure. He must be a man of some consequence, for he was lodging at the Palace Hotel.
Saturn in Libra, in which Harold Nielsen reneges upon a contract. The Holy Book is opened, Carol Devlin is confounded, and George Shepherd forms a plan. Harold Nielsen had just brewed and steeped his 4 o'clock pot of tea, and was sitting down to a plate of sugared biscuits and a book, when he received a summons in the Penny Post. It was from George Shepherd and marked urgent, though the jailer did not specify a reason why. Doubtless it concerned some detail of infinitesimal consequence, Nielsen thought with irritation. Some piece of gravel in the jailhouse foundation, some drop of coffee on the jailhouse plans. Sighing, he fitted a quilted cosy around his teapot, exchanged his jersey for a jacket, and reached for his stick. It was jolly bad form to bother a man on a Sunday afternoon. Why, he had been working 6 days out of seven. He deserved a day of rest, without George Shepherd plaguing him for receipts or wage records or quotes on salvage. The Penny Post was an added insult, for Shepherd could not even trouble himself to walk the 5 short blocks from the police camp to Gibson Quay. Instead, he insisted that Nielsen come to him as a servant to a liege. Nielsen was in a very bad temper as he locked the door of his office behind him and strode off down Revel Street with his hat set at an angle and his coat-tails flared. At the police camp, Mrs. George answered the door. She directed Nielsen with a very sorry aspect into the dining room, and then fled before Nielsen could speak any words of politeness, pulling the door so firmly closed behind her that the calico wall gave a shudder, and Nielsen had the fleeting sensation of being at sea. The jailer was sitting at the head of the table, where he was making short work of a cold meal composed of jellied meats, various cold puddings of homogeneous consistency, and a dense bread of some dark, large, crumbed kind. He held himself very straight as he stacked his fork, and did not offer Nielsen a chair.
"So," he said, when the door had closed and he had swallowed his mouthful, "you told somebody about our agreement. You broke your word. Whom did you tell?"
"What?" said Nielsen.
Shepherd repeated his question. Nielsen, after a pause, repeated his bewilderment at a slightly higher pitch. Shepherd's expression was cold.
"Do not lie to me, Mr. Nielsen. Alistair Lauderback is to publish a letter in the Times tomorrow morning lambasting my character. He claims that a percentage of the fortune discovered on Crosby Wells' estate was invested in the Hokitika jailhouse. I do not know how he came upon this information, and I wish to know at once."
Nielsen faltered. How was it possible that Alistair Lauderback knew about his commission? One of the Crown men must have broken his word. Balfour, perhaps. Balfour and Lauderback were close familiars, and Nielsen had never seen Lauderback in the company of any of the rest. But what reason could Balfour have to betray him? Nielsen had never wished him any kind of harm. Could it have been Löwenthal? Perhaps, if the letter was to be published in the paper. But Nielsen could not believe that Löwenthal had broken his word any more than he could believe it of Balfour. He watched Shepherd assemble a forkful of jellied meats, pickled cucumber and hash, and inexplicably, for Nielsen was not at all hungry, his own mouth began to water.
"Whom did you tell?" Shepherd said. "Please mark this moment as the end of my patience. I will not ask you again."
He put his mouth over his assembled forkful, slid the food off the fork, and chewed. Nielsen did not know how to respond. The truth, of course, was that he had told 12 men, Walter Moody, plus the 11 others who had been summoned to the smoking room of the Crown. He could hardly admit to having betrayed Shepherd's secret to 12 men. Ought he to pretend that he had told no one at all? But it was obvious that he had broken his confidence to someone, if Lauderback knew. His mind was racing. "I can't think how it might have happened," he said, in desperation. "I can't think." Shepherd was busy stacking another mouthful on the back of his fork.
"Did you go to Lauderback yourself?" he said, his eyes fixed intently upon his dinner. "Or did you go to another man, who went to Lauderback in his turn?"
"I haven't spoken 5 words to Lauderback in all my life," Harold Nielsen said, with much indignation.
"Who then?"
Shepherd looked up, his utensils loose in his hands. Nielsen said nothing. He had begun to perspire.
"You are keeping a digger's honour, I see," Shepherd said with disapproval. "Well, at least someone has your loyalty, Mr. Nielsen."
He turned back to his dinner and did not speak for what Nielsen felt was a very long time. Shepherd was dressed in his Sunday suit of black. He had flung his coat-tails to the sides of his chair so that they would not be creased beneath him while he ate. His high-waisted trousers and collarless vest had a disapproving, funereal look, and his wide cravat, somewhat out of fashion, Nielsen noticed with a touch of condescension, his own cravat was thin and loosely tied, following the style of the day, seemed to accent the jailer's aspect of admonishment still further. Even his cold supper was abstemious in its plainness. Nielsen himself had dined upon a half of boiled chicken, served with mashed buttered turnip and a great deal of white sauce. He had drunk half a pitcher of a very nice wine besides. From elsewhere in the house, a clock sounded the quarter hour. Mrs. George moved beyond the flimsy walls, padding from room to room. Shepherd remained fixated on his meal. Nielsen waited until Shepherd had cleaned his plate of every last crumb, hoping that once his meal was concluded, the jailer might begin to speak. When it became evident that this hope was a false one, he said somewhat feebly, "Well, what are you going to do?"
"My first action," Shepherd replied, daubing his mouth with a table napkin, "will be to relieve you of all duties pertaining to the construction of the jailhouse. I will not be served by a man who breaks his word."
"The investment will be returned to me," said Nielsen.
"Not at all," said Shepherd. He tossed the table napkin onto his plate. "In fact, I consider that a most unreasonable request, given that the work is already well underway."
Nielsen worked his mouth.
At length he said, "I understand."
"You will not break your digger's code?"
"No."
"Incredible.
I am sorry."
Shepherd pushed his plate away, becoming brisk.
"Mr. Lauderback's letter will be published tomorrow in the Times. I have an advance copy here."
Nielsen saw that there was an opened letter on the table next to the jailer's plate. He stepped forward, putting out his hand.
"May I?"
But Shepherd ignored him.
"The letter," he went on, raising his voice slightly, "does not refer to you by name. You should know that I will be writing to the editor myself tonight in order to correct that omission. My response will be published below Mr. Lauderback's as a formal reply."
Nielsen tried again.
"May I read it?"
"You may read it tomorrow in the paper, along with every other man in Westland."
Shepherd uttered the phrase with a dangerous emphasis.
"All right," Nielsen said. He withdrew his hand. "I take your meaning."
Shepherd paused before adding,
"Unless, of course, there's something that you'd like to tell me."
In a voice of loathsome dejection, Nielsen said,
"Yes."
"Yes?"
"Yes, there's something."
Poor Harold Nielsen, thinking that he might regain the jailer's trust by means of a second transgression, as though by committing a second disloyalty he might reverse the fact of the first. He had conceded in a panic, for it crushed Nielsen's spirit to be held in low esteem by other men. He could not bear to know that he was disliked, for to him there was no real difference between being disliked and being dislikable. Every injury he sustained was an injury to his very selfhood. It was for reasons of self-protection that Nielsen dressed in the latest fashions and spoke with affectation and placed himself as the central character of every tale. He built his persona as a shield around his person, because he knew very well how little his person could withstand.
"Pray continue," Shepherd said.
"It's about," Nielsen cast about wildly, "Mrs. Wells."
"Indeed," Shepherd said. "How so?"
"She was Lauderback's mistress."
Shepherd raised his eyebrows.
"Alistair Lauderback was cuckolded in Crosby Wells?"
Nielsen thought about it.
"Yes, I suppose he was. Well, it would depend on when Crosby and Lydia got married, of course."
"Go on," Shepherd said.
The thing is, he was blackmailed. Lauderback, I mean. And Crosby Wells took home the ransom. That's the fortune, you see, in Crosby's cottage."
"How did this blackmail happen? And how do you know about it?"
Nielsen hesitated. He did not trust the jailer's expression, which had suddenly become very greedy and intense.
"How do you know about it?"
Shepherd demanded.
"Somebody told me."
"Who?"
"Mr. Staines," said Nielsen, settling upon the man to whom he could do the least damage, in the short term at least.
"Was he the blackmailer, Staines?"
"I don't know," said Nielsen, momentarily confused. "I mean, yes, maybe."
"Are you with him or against him?"
I don't know."
Shepherd looked annoyed.
"What have you got on him, then?" he said. "You must have something on the man if you're not sure about your allegiance."
"There was a deed of gift,"
Nielsen said miserably,
"in Crosby Wells' stove. Partly burned, as though someone tried to destroy it. The chaplain found it. When he went to the cottage to
collect the body the day after his death. He didn't tell you about it. He kept it for himself. He didn't tell Dr. Gillies, either.
Shepherd betrayed no flicker of emotion at all. What kind of a deed of gift? Nielsen briefly detailed the particulars of the contract. He kept his eyes upon a spot some 3 feet to the left of the jailer's face and squinted oddly, for a bubble of despair was growing in his chest, pushing out against his breastbone. He had meant to reassure the jailer of his loyalty by betraying this secret. Now he saw that he had only confirmed his disloyalty and his worthlessness. And yet, despite his misery, there was something terribly relieving about speaking of the Crown conspiracy aloud. He felt that a great weight was being lifted off his shoulders, just as he felt that a terrible weightlessness was settling in its place. He glanced at the jailer quickly, and then away.
"Is Devlin your man?" Shepherd said. "Did you tell Devlin about this investment? And did he tell Lauderback?"
"Yes," Nielsen said. "That's right."
What kind of wretched man was he to accuse a clergyman? But of course it was only half a lie, and better to accuse one man than all 12.
"I mean," he added, "I only suppose he told Lauderback. I don't know. I've never spoken to Lauderback about anything at all, as I told you."
"So Devlin is Lauderback's man," Shepherd said.
"I don't know about that," said Nielsen. "I don't know about that at all."
Shepherd nodded.
"Well, Mr. Nielsen," he said, rising from the table, "that concludes our discussion, I think."
It panicked Nielsen still further to be dismissed.
"The part about the deed," he said, "it's just, if you're going to mention it to the Reverend—"
"I imagine that I will, yes."
"Well, can you leave my name out of it?"
said Nielsen, with a look of pure misery on his face.
"You see, I can tell you where he's keeping it, the deed, I mean, and that way you can come upon it yourself, and there's no bridges broken on my end. Will you do that?"
Shepherd studied him without pity.
"Where does he keep it?"
"I won't tell you until you give your word," said Nielsen. Shepherd shrugged.
"All right."
"Do you give your word?"
"Upon my honour, I will not speak your name to the chaplain of the jail," Shepherd snapped. "Where does he keep it?"
"In his Bible," said Nielsen very sadly. "In his Bible, between the Old Testament and the New."
Since the construction of the jailhouse had begun in earnest, Carol Devlin and George Shepherd had not seen a great deal of one another, save for in the evenings when Shepherd returned from the construction site at Seaview to write his letters and tally his accounts. Devlin, who found the atmosphere of the temporary police camp much improved in Shepherd's absence, had not pursued a deeper intimacy with the other man. Had he been pressed to pass judgment on the jailer's character, he might, after a long pause, have conceded that he pitied Shepherd's rigidity and mourned the evident displeasure with which Shepherd seemed to regard the world around him. After another pause, he might have added that he wished Shepherd well, but did not expect the relations between them to develop beyond their present capacity, which was strictly professional and none too warm. That day was a Sunday, however, and construction on the terrace had halted for the day. Shepherd had spent the morning at chapel, and the afternoon in his study at the police camp, from which place Harold Nielsen was now very rapidly departing. Devlin, who had recently returned from the Canieri camp, was in the temporary jailhouse, preaching to the felons on the subject of rote prayer. He had brought his battered Bible with him, as he always did whenever he left his tent, though the nature of that day's sermon was such that he had had no cause to open it that afternoon. When Shepherd stepped into the jailhouse, it was lying closed upon a chair at Devlin's side. Shepherd waited for a lull in the conversation, which came about within moments, owing to his imposing presence in the room. Devlin turned an inquiring face up at him, and Shepherd said,
"Good afternoon, Reverend. Hand me your Bible, would you please?"
Devlin frowned.
"My Bible?"
"If you wouldn't mind."
The chaplain placed his palm over the book.
"Perhaps you may simply ask me what it is you seek," he said. "I pride myself that I do know my scriptures rather well."
I do not doubt it. And yet, browsing is a pleasure to me, Shepherd replied.
But of course, you have a Bible of your own.
Of course, Shepherd agreed. However, it is the hour of my wife's devotions, and I do not like to disturb her. For a moment, Devlin considered extracting the purloined deed himself, but its charred aspect would surely not escape the jailer's comment, and in any case, he was surrounded by felons. Where would he hide the thing?
What is it that you're looking for exactly? He said. A verse or an allusion?
You are very chary of your Bible for a man of God, Shepherd snapped. Heavens, man, I only wish to look through the pages. You will deny me that?
And Devlin was obliged to surrender it. Shepherd, thanking him, took the book back to his private residence and closed the door. Devlin's sermon on rote prayer was perversely applicable to the ensuing half hour, for it was with a ritual circularity that his attention kept straying to the jailer's study, where the man would be seated behind his desk, turning the thin pages of the book in his great white hands. Devlin did not guess that Shepherd might have known about the deed that he had concealed between the testaments, for his nature was not a suspicious one, and he did not take pleasure, as some men did, in believing himself to have been betrayed. He hoped, as the minutes dragged by, that Shepherd would restrict his reading to the more ancient parts of the text. He hoped that the book would be returned to him with the charred deed undiscovered and untouched. Devlin knew very well that Shepherd's faith was of a staunchly Levitican variety. It was not unreasonable to hope that he might confine his browsing to the Pentateuch or to Chronicles and Kings. He was hardly likely to favour the minor prophets, but the Gospels were standard fare, most especially for a Sunday. He was very likely to turn there, whatever his persuasion, and in that case he would almost certainly come across the hidden page. Finally, the afternoon's discussion came to an end, and Devlin, in a posture of some dread, took his leave of the felons in his spiritual charge. The duty sergeant nodded goodbye, stifling a yawn. Devlin let himself out. A hush fell over the jailhouse. He crossed the courtyard, mounted the steps to the porch of the jailer's cottage, and knocked upon the door. From within, Shepherd's deep voice bid him to enter. Devlin did so, and crossed the calico hallway to the jailer's study. The door was open. Devlin saw at once that his Bible lay open on the jailer's desk, with the charred slip of paper on top of it, in full view. On this, the 11th day of October 1865, a sum of £2,000 is to be given to Miss Anna Wetherill, formerly of New South Wales, by Mr. Emery Staines, formerly of New South Wales, as witnessed by Mr. Crosby Wells, presiding. Shepherd folded his hands and waited for his guest to speak.
"Something I found," Devlin said, "but it's no use to anyone."
"No use to anyone?" Shepherd queried pleasantly. "Why on earth do you say that?"
"It's invalid," Devlin said. "The principal hasn't signed, therefore it's not legal."
Cowell Devlin, like all men who will not admit fault to themselves, was loath to admit fault to any other man. He became very arch and condescending whenever he was accused of doing ill.
"No, indeed," said Shepherd. "It's not legal."
"It's not binding, that's what I meant," Devlin said with a slight frown. "It's not binding in the legal sense."
Shepherd did not blink.
"Which is rather a shame, wouldn't you say?"
"Why is that?"
"If only Emery Staines had signed it, why, half of the fortune discovered at Crosby Wells Cottage would belong to Anna Wetherill. That would be a turn of events, would it not?"
"But the fortune in the hermit's cottage never belonged to Emery Staines."
"No," Shepherd said. "Forgive me. You seem to be rather more certain of that fact than I am."
Hal Devlin knew very well that the gold in Crosby Wells' cottage had originated from 4 gowns, sewn up by Lydia Wells, purchased by Anna Wetherill. He knew that the gold had been siphoned and then retorted by the goldsmith R. Quee, only to be stolen by Staines and concealed in Wells' cottage at some point thereafter.
He could not say any of this to Shepherd, however. Instead, he said, "There is no reason to think that the fortune belonged to Mr. Staines."
"Beyond the fact that Mr. Staines vanished upon the day of Mr. Wells' death, and Mr. Wells was not, to popular understanding, a man of means."
Shepherd stabbed the deed with his index finger.
"This certainly seems pertinent, Reverend, to our case at hand. This document appears to indicate that the fortune originated with Staines, and that Staines meant to give half of it, exactly half, to a common prostitute. I would hazard to guess that Crosby Wells, as his witness, was keeping the fortune for him when he died."
This was a reasonable hypothesis. Perhaps Shepherd was right upon the latter point, Devlin thought, though of course he was mistaken upon the former. Aloud, he said,
"You are right that it seems pertinent. However, as I've told you already, the contract is not valid. Mr. Staines has not signed his name."
"I presume that you found this deed in Crosby Wells' cottage the day you went to collect his remains."
"That is correct," Devlin said.
"If you have kept such careful custody of it," Shepherd said, "then I dare say it occurred to you how very valuable this deed might be to certain persons. To Anna Wetherill, for instance. By this paper's authority, she could become the richest woman this side of the Southern Alps."
"She could not," Devlin said.
"The deed is unsigned."
"If it were to be signed," Shepherd said.
"Amory Staines is dead," Devlin said.
"Is he?" Shepherd said. "Dear me, another certainty that we do not share."
But Carol Devlin was not easily intimidated.
"The promise of great riches is a dangerous thing," he said, folding his hands across his navel in the clerical way. "It is a temptation like no other, for it is the temptation of great influence and great opportunity, and these are things we all desire. If Miss Wetherill were to be told about this deed, her hopes would be falsely raised. She would start dreaming of great influence and great opportunity. She would no longer be contented with the life she led before. This was a circumstance I feared. I therefore resolved to keep the information to myself, at least until Amory Staines was either recovered or found to be dead. If he is found dead, I will destroy the deed. But if he lives, I shall go to him and show him the paper and ask him whether he wishes to sign it. The choice would be his own."
"And what if Staines is never found?" the jailer said. "What then?"
"I made my decision with compassion, Mr. Shepherd," Devlin said firmly. "I feared very much what would happen to poor Miss Wetherill should that deed of gift be made public, or should it fall into the wrong hands. If Mr. Staines is never found, then no hopes will be dashed, and no blood spilled, and no faith lost. I judge that to be no small mercy. Don't you?"
Shepherd's pale eyes had become wet,
a sign that he was thinking hard. "As witnessed by Crosby Wells," he murmured, "presiding."
"In any case," Devlin added, "it's hardly likely that a man would give such a great deal of money to a prostitute. Most likely it is a joke or deceit of some kind."
Shepherd looked suddenly amused. "You doubt the woman's talents?"
"You mistake me," Devlin said calmly. "I only meant that for a man to give £2,000 to a whore is a very unlikely situation. As a gift, I mean. And all at once."
Abruptly, Shepherd shut the Bible with a snap, trapping the purloined document between the pages. He handed the book back to the chaplain, already reaching with his other hand for his pen, as though the affair was no longer of any interest to him.
"Thank you for the loan of your Bible," he said, and nodded to indicate that Devlin was free to leave. He then bent over his ledger and began to tally up his columns.
Devlin hovered uncertainly for a moment, the Bible in his hand. The charred document protruded from one edge, dividing the profile of the book into unequal halves. "But what do you think?" he said at last. "What do you make of it?" Shepherd did not pause in his writing.
"What do I make of what?"
"The contract."
"I imagine you are right. It must be a joke or deceit of some kind," Shepherd said.
He placed a finger on his ledger to hold his place, and then reached over to dip his pen into his inkwell. "Oh," said Devlin, "yes."
"The contract is invalid, as you say," Shepherd said conversationally.
He tapped the nib of the pen against the rim of the inkwell. "Yes."
"The witness is certainly dead, and the principal almost certainly so."
"Yes."
"But if you want an answer from the horse's mouth, then perhaps you ought to go along to the Wayfarer's Fortune tonight, with all the other heathens."
"To speak with Mr. Staines?"
"To speak with Anna," the jailer said with pointed disapproval. "Now, if you don't mind, Reverend, I have rather a lot of work to do."
After Devlin had closed the door behind him, Shepherd laid down his pen, went to his bookcase, and pulled out a file, out of which he extracted a single sheet of paper. The only copy of the contract he had made 3 weeks ago with Harold Nielsen, under which the commission merchant had promised not to speak of his £400 investment to any other man. Shepherd struck a match on the side of the cabinet and touched it to the piece of paper, holding it lightly by one corner and tilting it until the document was aflame and the signatures obscured. When he could hold it no longer, he tossed it to the floor, watched it shrink to a grey nothing, and kicked the ashes aside with the toe of his boot. Sitting back down at his desk, he pulled a fresh sheet of paper from beneath his ledger, took up his pen, and dipped his nib. Then, in a slow, measured hand, he wrote,
"A gift of conscience to the editor of the West Coast Times, the 18th of February, 1866. Sir, I write in response to Mr. Alistair Lauderback, Provincial Councilman, MP, who casts damaging aspersions upon the undersigned, and therefore upon all his associates, including the Westland Public Works Committee, the Municipal Council, the Office of the Commissioner, the Hokitika Board, etc. It is my duty to correct Mr. Lauderback's errors of propriety, of decency, and of fact. Indeed, the construction of the future Hokitika jailhouse was aided in the large part by a donation made by a Westland man. Mr. Harold Nielsen of Nielsen and Co. donated to the council a sum of approximately £400 to be used, as per his personal instruction, for public good. This sum represented the commission received by him as payment for honest employment. It was, as Mr. Lauderback attests, a portion of the fortune discovered on Mr. Crosby Wells' estate, to which Mr. Nielsen, commission merchant, was legally entitled, as payment for services satisfactorily rendered. Mr. Lauderback will be pleased to recall that in legal phrasing, a donation is distinct from an investment, in that a donation does not create a relationship of the debtor-creditor variety. In plain language, a donation does not have to be repaid. In understanding that Mr. Nielsen's donation was an act of charity of the most virtuous and selfless order, Mr. Lauderback will further acknowledge that no laws have been broken and no regulations breached. I hold that the profoundest and most enduring testament to progress in civilization is the creation of public works, and I am satisfied that the Hokitika jailhouse will bear up under this definition in every respect. Should Mr. Lauderback find this explanation insufficiently transparent for his tastes, I cordially invite him to disclose to the voting public what he has hitherto concealed, that he has enjoyed a formerly intimate relation with Mrs. Lydia Wells, widow to Crosby. I anticipate Mr. Lauderback's full disclosure upon this matter, and remain yours, etc., George M. Shepherd.
When he was done, Shepherd blotted the page, reached for a clean sheet of paper, and transcribed the letter in full, creating a replica so exact, in fact, that one would have to compare them for quite some time before one perceived the smallest difference. He then folded both pages, sealed them, and wrote two addresses in his laborious hand. Once the wax was dry, he rang the bell for Mrs. George and asked her to summon the penny postman for the second time that day. This instruction was promptly carried out. The penny postman was a freckled thing with a mass of yellow curls.
"This one to Lerventhal at the Times," Shepherd said. "This gets delivered first. And this one goes to Harold Nilsson at the auction yards on Gibson Quay. All right?"
"Is there a message?"
said the young man, pocketing the letters.
"Only for Mr. Nilsson," said Shepherd. "You tell Mr. Nilsson that he's expected at work tomorrow morning. Can you remember that? Tell him no complaints, no hard feelings, and no questions asked."
Mars in Capricorn, in which Gascoigne finds common ground with Francis Carver, Sukyong Sheng acts upon a false impression, and Kui Long gives the Avenger some advice. Aubert Gascoigne had what one might call a lubber's love of ships. In the last 3 weeks he had ventured to the Hokitika Spit several times in order to meditate upon the fractured hull of the Godspeed, and to chart her progress as she was shunted, by degrees, closer and closer to the shore. Now that the wreck had at last been hauled onto the sand, he had a much better opportunity to look her over, and to gauge, with his lubber's eye, the extent of the damage that she had sustained. It was here that he had come upon taking his leave of Moody, having no other occupation that Sunday afternoon, for he had read the papers already, and he was not thirsty, and the day was much too bright and cheerful to remain indoors. He had been sitting with his back against the beacon for some hours, watching the progress of the ship's recovery, and turning a green-flecked stone in his hands. Beside him he had constructed a little castle, the ramparts made of stacks of flattened pebbles pressed into mounds of sand. When, sometime after 5, the wind suddenly changed direction, blowing his collar against his neck and sending a damp chill down his spine, Gascoigne decided to retire. He stood, dusting himself down, and was wondering whether he ought to kick his castle apart or leave it intact, when he perceived that a man was standing some 50 yards away. The man's feet were planted rather far apart, and his arms were folded as though in disapproval. His posture in general communicated an implacability of the most humourless kind, as did his dress, which was sombre. He turned his head slightly, and Gascoigne caught, for a brief moment, the glassy shine of a scar. Gascoigne and Francis Carver had never formally met, though of course the latter's reputation was well known to Gascoigne, coloured chiefly by the report that Anna Wetherill had given more than a month ago on the subject of the murder of her unborn child. Such a report was more than sufficient provocation to avoid the former captain altogether, but Gascoigne's ill-feeling was of the kind that needed private affirmation rather than public display. He gained a real pleasure in befriending a man whom he privately had cause to despise, for he liked very much the feeling that his regard for others was a private font, a well that he could muddy or drink from at his own discreet pleasure and on his own time. He walked up to Carver, already raising his hat.
"Excuse me, sir, are you the captain of this craft?"
Francis Carver eyed him, and then after a moment nodded.
"I was."
The white scar on his cheek was slightly puckered at one end, as when a seamstress leaves the needle in the fabric before she quits for the day. This phantom needle lay just beyond the edge of his mouth and seemed to tug it upward, as if trying to coax his stern expression, unsuccessfully, into a smile.
"If I could introduce myself, Aubert Gascoigne," Gascoigne said, putting out his hand. "I am a clerk at the magistrate's court."
"A clerk?" Carver eyed him again. "What kind?"
Rather reluctantly, he shook Gascoigne's hand,
showing his reluctance by way of a grip that was limp and very brief.
"Very low level," Gascoigne said, without condescension. "Petty claims, mostly. Nothing too large. But there is the occasional insurance claim that comes across our desks. That craft, for example."
He pointed to the wreck of a steamer lying on its side just beyond the river mouth, some 50 yards from where they were standing.
"We managed to scrape even on that one, though barely. The master was very well pleased. He had been facing down a £500 debt."
"Insurance," said Carver.
"Among other things, yes. I have some personal acquaintance with the subject also," Gascoigne added, pulling out his cigarette case, "for my late wife's father was a maritime insurer."
"Which firm?" said Carver.
"Lloyd's of London."
Gascoigne snapped open the silver case.
"I have been charting Godspeed's progress these past few weeks. I am gratified to see that she has been hauled clear of the surf at last. What a project it has been! A monumental effort, if I may praise the work of the crew, and your work, sir, in commandeering it."
Carver watched him for a moment, and then turned his gaze back to the deck of the Godspeed. With his eyes fixed on his foundered craft, he said,
"What do you want?"
"Certainly not to offend you," Gascoigne said, holding his cigarette lightly between his fingers and pausing a moment, his palms upturned. "I am sure I do not mean to intrude upon your privacy in any way. I have been watching the progress of the ship's recovery, that's all. It is a rare privilege to see such a craft upon dry land. One really gets a sense of her."
Carver kept his eyes on the ship.
"I meant, are you set to sell me something?"
Gascoigne was lighting his cigarette and took a moment to answer. "Not at all," he said at last, blowing a white puff of smoke over his shoulder.
"I'm not affiliated with any insurance firms. This is a personal interest, you might say. A curiosity."
Carver said nothing.
"I like to sit on the beach on Sundays," Gascoigne added, "when the weather is nice. But you must tell me if my private interest offends you."
Carver jerked his head.
"Didn't mean to be uncivil."
Gascoigne waved the apology away.
"One hates to see a fine ship come to ground."
"She's fine, all right."
"Marvellous. A frigate, is she not?"
"A bark."
Gascoigne murmured his appreciation.
"British made?"
He nodded.
"That's copper sheathing, you can see."
Gascoigne nodded absently.
"Yes, a fine craft. I do hope she was insured."
"You can't drop anchor at a port without insurance," Carver said. "Same for every vessel. Without it, they won't let you land. Thought you'd know that, if you know anything about insurance at all."
He spoke in a voice that was flat and full of contempt, seeming not to care how his words might be interpreted, or remembered, or used.
"Of course, of course," Gascoigne said airily. "I mean to say that I am glad that you are not out of pocket. For your sake."
Carver snorted.
"I'll be £1,000 down when all is said and done," he said. "Everything that you can see right now is costing money, and out of my pocket."
Gascoigne paused a moment before asking, "What about P and I?"
"Dunno."
"Protection and indemnity," Gascoigne explained, "against extraordinary liabilities."
"Don't know,"
Carver said again.
"You don't belong to a ship owners' association?"
"No."
Gascoigne inclined his head gravely.
"Ah," he said, "so you'll have been liable for all this,"
indicating with a sweep of his hand the beached hull before him, the screwjacks, the horses, the tugboats, the rollers, and the winch.
"Yes," said Carver, still without emotion. "Everything you can see. And I'm bound to pay every man a guinea more than he's worth for standing about and tying his shoelaces and untying them and conferencing about conferencing until everyone's out of breath and I'm £1,000 down."
"I am sorry," Gascoigne said. "Would you like a cigarette?"
Carver eyed his silver case.
"No," he said after a moment. "Thanks. Don't care for them. Gascoigne drew deeply on his own cigarette and stood for a moment thinking.
"You certainly seem set to sell me something," Carver said again.
"A cigarette?" Gascoigne laughed. "That was offered quite free of charge."
"I reckon I'm still freer for having turned it down," said Carver.
And Gascoigne laughed again. "Tell me," he said, "how long ago did you purchase this ship?"
"You've got a lot of questions," Carver said. "What's your business asking them?"
"Well, I suppose it doesn't really matter," Gascoigne said. "It would only matter if you made the purchase less than a year ago. Never mind." But he had snagged Carver's interest. The other man looked over at him and then said,
"I've had her 10 months. Since May."
"Ah," Gascoigne said. "Well, that's very interesting. That could work in your favour, you know."
"How?"
But Gascoigne didn't answer at once. Instead, he squinted his eyes and pretended to brood.
"The man who sold it to you, did he pass on conventional cover? That is to say, did you inherit an extant policy, or did you take out a policy on your own account?"
"I didn't take out anything," Carver said.
"Was the vendor a shipowner in the professional sense? Did he own more than just Godspeed, for example?"
"He had a couple of others," Carver said. "Clipper ships. Charters."
"Not steam?"
"Sail," said Carver. "Why?"
"And where did you say you were coming from when you ran aground?"
"Dunedin. Are you going to tell me where all these questions are headed?"
"Only from Dunedin," Gascoigne said, nodding. "Yes. Now, if you'll forgive my impertinence one last time, I wonder if I might ask about the circumstances of the wreck itself. I trust there was no dereliction of duty or anything of that kind that caused the ship to flounder?"
Carver shook his head. "Tide was low, but we were well offshore," he said. "I dropped 65 feet of chain and she caught, so I dropped 2 anchors and another 20 feet of chain. I made the call to keep her on a reasonable leash and wait until the morning. Next thing we knew, we were broadside on the spit. It was raining, and the moon was clouded over. The wind blew out the beacons. Wasn't anything anyone could have done. Nothing that might be called dereliction.